Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Ömer Taşpınar, the director of the Turkey program here, and we're very happy today to have two analysts with us to look at a very important question, a question which relates to the difficult issue of democratization in Turkey. Our goal here at Brookings is independent analysis, and we try to usually bring together diverging views so that you get an opportunity to hear basically the debate as it is in Turkey. And I think part of the problem in Washington and in the West in general is that there's this perception in Turkey that the real political struggle is between Islam and secularism. And this is becoming a kind of cliche, conventional wisdom. And as in most cliches and conventional wisdom, there is an element of truth to that. There is indeed a clash between Islam and secularism. However, that is often the facade, and beyond the clash between secularism and Islam, there are analytical studies that show that there is also a power struggle, and there are some studies that also talk about a struggle between democracy and authoritarianism. And those are all polarizing issues, and I'm sure as for all of you who follow Turkey, Turkey is a polarized country today. So our goal today is to try to go beyond the conventional wisdom and the facade and the cliche of Islam and secularism and to look at the nature of this power struggle by looking at essentially two questions, the civil-military dimension of the power struggle, in what ways the civilian government and the military interact, and the relevance of this question of civil-military relations for the larger issue of democratization. And second, to try to understand the dynamics within what appears to be a new actor in Turkish, in the Turkish political struggle, which is the judiciary. What is the role of the judiciary? And recently in the Turkish political context, there has been a lot of analysis which talks about the politicization of the judiciary, which is a very troubling notion for all democracies, since their democracies are supposed to be based on a separation of powers. So by looking at the civil-military dimensions and the judiciary, we'll try to basically understand the larger democratization problem and unavoidably the question of Ergenekon, this case about an underground organization which allegedly tried to destabilize the country for an eventual coup. Is very much part of this discussion, yet it is not the entire issue. There has been a lot of focus on Ergenekon, and Gerrit has published an important analysis of Ergenekon, and some of you may be familiar with that. So we're very pleased to have both Gerrit Jenkins, who is currently a senior fellow at the Central Asia and Caucasus Institute, which is part of Johns Hopkins University. And that institute has a particular program called the Silk Road Studies and the Turkey Project. He's a senior fellow with them. But more importantly, he has been an independent analyst living in Istanbul since 1989, I think. And he has published a number of very important studies, including on civil-military relations. And we're very pleased to have him back in Washington. And we'll start with his analysis. He'll speak for 20 minutes, and then we'll go to Etienne Mahçupyan. We're very proud and happy to have Etienne Mahçupyan among us here. Etienne wears many hats. He is the director of the democratization program at TESEV, which is, I think, one of the first and most prestigious think tanks in Istanbul, in Ankara, in Turkey. And in addition to his important job at TESEV, he is also the editor-in-chief of the Turkish-Armenian newspaper Agos, and he's also a columnist for a newspaper that some of you may know, which has become an important newspaper, especially in this context of civil-military relations and the Ergenekon case, called Taraf. So we're very happy that Etienne is here. He will speak after Gerrit, and then we will have, I think, about an hour for the Q&A. So thank you all for coming, and with that, I'll let Gerrit start.
Okay. What I'm going to try to do is to answer A very simple question, but probably won't give a very simple answer to it. Is Turkey becoming more democratic? It's something we're hearing a lot recently. And I start by really, this democracy, I think we have to go back to this, because the word is banded around so freely without anybody being able to pin down a precise and universally accepted definition of what it means. But just to give some basic criteria which are usually included. Of course, one of the things is, a mechanism or is it a set of values is the first question that we have to answer. Is it merely a process through which the majority of the population elect the government, or does it bring with it a certain accepted set of values? The tendency today is usually to say that it brings with it some values. And this is just a kind of very quick checklist. There are other things I'm sure you could add to this as well, such as free elections, a free press, essentially, if you're going to have a public who can make an informed choice about their governments, general freedom of expression, an independent judiciary, security forces who are independent of any political influence, military, which are under civilian control, a transparent governmental system, a government which is accountable, checks and balances within the system, and separation of powers. In practice, I think, and the reason I'm mentioning this, as I'll come back to towards the end, is you also need to have an effective and viable opposition. So you have an alternative to whatever party is in power. We look at the situation before 2002, before the AKP, the AK Party, came to power. Is it possible to say that Turkey met all of these criteria? No. Elections were fairly free. Certain parties were banned. There were restrictions on what you could say in the press. There wasn't really any accountability of governments. It's still a striking feature of the Turkey today. We do not have ex-ministers or ex-bureaucrats in prison for corruption. And anybody who's been familiar with Turkish politics in the last 20 or 30 years know there should be quite a lot of them in prison for corruption. So we don't have any, didn't really have accountability before. Did we have independent security forces and independent judiciary? Well, yes and no. Independent of a political party, yes, I think, certainly in the period 1983 to 2002. I'm not saying it necessarily changed afterwards. I'll come to that in a minute. But in this period before 2002. Independent, completely politically independent? No, I don't think anybody can realistically say that. In terms of people who were opposed to the official ideology, then they didn't have the same rights as those who were supportive of the official ideology. The two bastions, of course, of the official ideology of Kemalism were a secular state and a unitary Turkish state. So were people opposed to the prevailing interpretation of secularism in Turkey, and those who were opposed to the unitary Turkish state did tend to have their views suppressed, and they were not, I think it's very difficult to argue they're treated equally by the judiciary. So really, I think before 2002, we already have in Turkey a semi-democratic system. One of the most striking features of Turkish politics, of course, over the last 50 years, but particularly since 1980 with the military coup, has been the position of the military in civil-military relations. The way the military exercised political influence up to 2002 was, although it had certain rights embodied in certain laws, had membership of the National Security Council. I won't go through all the details. If you want to get into some of these details in the Q&A, I'll try to answer your questions. But it influenced mainly through informal means. I think it's very important, particularly for the pressure that the European Union put on Turkey to change. The main influence of the Turkish military was behind the scenes, expressing an opinion and informally setting parameters outside which no government would dare to step. Within those parameters, governments had quite a lot of leeway. It was only when the military saw a government trying to step outside those parameters that it tended to apply pressure to the government. Again, it was mostly informal, expression of opinion, sometimes on an institutional platform like the National Security Council, sometimes behind the scenes in one-to-one conversations between military officials and governmental officials. If that didn't work, you'd often get an expression of an opinion by a leading member of the military in the expectation that then the government would toe the line. And up until 2002, broadly speaking, they did. in terms of not doing anything which was contrary to what the military wanted. Did that mean they always did what the military wanted? No, it doesn't. Even very famously with these 28th of February measures in 1997, when you look at how many of those, when the military presented the government at the time with an ultimatum, how many of those actually fulfilled, it's not very large. But they did not do anything, actively do anything contrary to what the military told them. Three main bastions of the Kemalist establishment protecting the this official ideology of Kemalism, certainly in the pre-2002 period, with the military itself, the judiciary, particularly the higher echelons of the judiciary, most strikingly, of course, the Constitutional Court, and YÖK, the supreme educational body which oversees education in the universities. That means a lot in the Turkish context because of the ban on women wearing universities, women wearing headscarves attending university, which in Turkey, the prevailing interpretation of secularism in Turkey is regarded as a breach of secularism. And so in order to preserve that, YÖK assumed enormous importance as a body overseeing university education. In November 2002, when the AK Party came to power, it came to power with approximately one-third of the popular vote, which under the Turkish electoral system gave it approximately two-thirds of the seats in parliament. It was very, very nervous about the military, was quite convinced that the military could evict it from power. In reality, despite what is often put, what often appears in the press, particularly in the last year or so, the military was aware at the time that it couldn't stage a coup to topple the government. But that didn't mean that the government was itself aware of this. So you had, during the AKP's first term in power, it behaving very, very cautiously. So from 2002, November, to July 2007, when there were fresh elections. In terms of its caution, it meant that sometimes it attempted to change something, it got a reaction from the military, and it backed down. The most striking example came after the local elections in March 2004, when it announced some educational reforms. It got a very good vote in there. It got 40% of the popular vote in these local elections, had a sudden surge of confidence and decided it was going to change some things to make it easier for graduates of the preacher training school, Imam Hatip Lisesi, to enter university and also to try to move towards lifting that headscarf ban in universities. When it got a reaction from the military, it immediately backed down because it still feared that the military could stage a coup. Under this period, of course, coincided 2002, certainly up until 2005, with a major reform drive for the EU membership. Now there's a temptation to say that the AKP initiated this reform drive, this democratization drive. This is slightly misleading, not completely misleading, but slightly misleading in that the reform started before the AKP came to power. The AKP certainly accelerated the reform drive. Some of the subjects which previously had been taboo to discuss, particularly on things like Kurdish rights, those restrictions began to be eased. I think if you look at what the AKP did during its first years in power, late 2002, and then going through to 2005, I think it's difficult to argue that any of the other parties in parliament or outside parliament would have displayed quite the same energy as the AKP did in trying to push through these democratizing reforms. But the key questions probably here to ask is why did the AKP do it, and look at some of the reforms themselves that were pushed through. At the time, the AKP was trying to get the opening, or it's a date for the opening of official accession negotiations with the EU. It also believed, I think sincerely, that once Turkey got in the EU, there would be a lifting on a lot of other restrictions as well. Most notably, and most importantly from the AKP's perspective, the expression of a religious identity in public life. So there was an element of self-interest in there. It's not the only explanation, but it did have an element of self-interest for people who thought similarly to the party itself, and also because it was very desperate to get the dates for the opening of accession negotiations. Once the AKP got the opening of the accession negotiations in October 2005, the reform drive died and still hasn't been resurrected. Most famously, from in April 2007, the then Chief of Staff, General Yasha Buchanet, posted a statement on the military's webpage, though not explicitly, threatening a military intervention if the AK pushed ahead with its candidate for the presidency. The AKP responded responded by calling fresh elections, which it won with a landslide. When Buchanan had issued the warning, when we look at when the military intervened in 1997 to the 28th of February process to force a previous Islamist government out of power, the ultimatum, these list of measures that it presented to the government were backed up by a very sophisticated propaganda campaign. Some of it was fairly open, some of it was behind the scenes. When Buchanan posted this statement on the military's webpage, that's all he did. He just posted a statement. The military didn't do anything else, didn't spread propaganda, didn't try to undermine the government in any other way. So really what the government did, the AKP did, by going to fresh elections was to call the military's bluff. When in July 2007, it won 46.6% of the popular vote, a very big increase on the 34% it had got in November 2002. It was a humiliating rebuff for the military. It had been publicly demonstrated to the military that it could no longer rely on this game of bluff of issuing statements to the government, expecting the government to follow its instructions. In December 2007, there had been appointment of a new head of YUK, the board that's controlling the universities in Turkey. The new head of this board is appointed by President Gül, was known to be sympathetic to the AKP, a very old associate of now the Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu. And effectively, by appointing this man, Yusuf Ziya Özcan, to head of YÖK, even if the AKP didn't take complete control of the university administration, it certainly removed what had previously been one of its main obstacles. So if you look at what I mentioned about the three bastions of the Kemalist establishment in terms of the military, YÖK, and the judicial system, we have now the military in late 2007 humiliated and to a certain extent marginalized by the failure of Buchanan's memorandum, this threat to oust the government. We now have somebody sympathetic to the government in charge of the university education. So we only have one bastion of the Kemalist establishment, which is just so far untouched. This huge vote that the AKP got in the election gave it a massive surge of confidence. You had a lot of discussions through 2007, the second half of 2007, about a new constitution. All of these talks about a new constitution were promptly dropped when, in January 2008, the AKP was notified by the MHP that it was prepared to back the government in trying to lift the headscarf ban through the existing constitution. These changes were passed in February 2008 and were eventually shot down by the Constitutional Court. And we also saw, after the election, a campaign that began against the military. I won't go into all the details, but the main thrust of the campaign is in the Ergenekon investigation. It's no coincidence that the Ergenekon investigation accelerated at a time when both the AK Party and its supporters thought that the military was no longer a threat. Previously, they'd been very frightened of the military. After the election victory in 2007, particularly AKP supporters within the judicial system, the lower echelons of the judicial system, the top is still being controlled by the Kemalist sympathizers, basically thought they could do whatever they want. The Ergenekon investigation is highly controversial. Some of those of you who've been following it would have seen the polemics that exist in the Turkish press, and of course there are a lot of polemics against me after I wrote the report that Irma mentioned. One thing I think is important to emphasize is that if you really want to find out what's going on in the Ergenekon investigation, don't listen to me, don't listen to the people who think differently to me, go and have a look at it yourselves. If you go and have a look at it yourselves, it's an enormous amount of material, I know, but you'll see a huge number of manifest abuses of Turkish law. There are many, many breaches of regulations, and these have accelerated. People have been kept in prison for a long time without even being charged or knowing what they're going to be charged with. A lot of people who have merely been opposed to the government have been taken in under accusation of being a member of the Ergenekon organization. There is no proof in any of the indictments or anything that's been brought to court that this organization, as described in the indictments, actually exists. We've seen more recently, particularly this year, two other cases in particular against the military. One, the so-called Cage Plan, which I won't go into detail, but we can come back to this if you want. And the other, the Sledgehammer Operation, which is supposed to portray a military plot for a military coup, which was formulated in December 2002 and discussed at a military seminar in March 2007. Again, if you look, don't listen to me, go and have a look at yourselves at what this so-called plan is supposed to contain, and you see that it falls apart immediately. Again, in the question and answer, if you have any questions, I'll give you some details, some examples how it falls apart. The cumulative effect of these campaigns, mainly against the military, has to force the military onto the defensive. All of them share the same characteristics of claiming the military was planning to stage not one, but a series of coups. Because so many people from the military, both serving and retired officers, have been detained, very often on absolutely no evidence whatsoever, in many cases in manifest breaches of Turkish law. And recently they've been re-detained, even after a judge ordered some of them to be released. They've been detained again, and the explanation given by the court, by the judge who ordered their re-arrest, was there was no evidence that they should be allowed to go free. So we have the situation now in Turkey where the accused are going to be presumed as being guilty unless they can prove something to the opposite. This is a very worrying development in terms of the rule of law in Turkey, and the fact that so many of the governing